Welcome to the Cool Tools Show. I'm Mark Frauenfelder, Editor-in-Chief of Cool Tools, a website of tool recommendations written by our readers. You can find us at cool-tools.org. I'm joined by my co-host, Kevin Kelly, founder of Cool Tools. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, it's great to be here.
In each episode of the Cool Tools Show, Kevin and I talk to a guest about some of his or her favorite uncommon and uncommonly good tools they think others should know about. Our guest this week is Cameo Wood. Cami is an Emmy-nominated filmmaker. She's also a former tech founder, founded an urban beekeeping store, was the first to perform Turing's original imitation game experiment, and has completed grad programs in Egyptology and medical neuroscience. Wow, that is an awesome bio, Cameo. How are you?
Good. Well, I just wrote it just for you, so I'm glad you liked it.
Hey, welcome, Cameo. We've know each other from other past lives, and it's so great to have you on Cool Tools.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. I have your book. I have the Cool Tools book, and yeah, I've been we've talked for years, and I'm so excited to be on the show that I've been reading the website for forever.
Yes. So you have some cool tools for us. Tell us about your first one of your favorite four tools.
So I was trying to think about tools that would be accessible to a larger number of people that I use all the time. So there's a company called Moment, and what they do is they create incredibly high quality lenses for photography or for filmmaking. And they have this new one called an anamorphic lens, which has incredibly high quality glass, and you can just pop this right on your iPhone and capture just beautiful images. Like, you can get all the lens flares that you want, this beautiful widescreen letterbox look. They have their own app, the Moment filmmaking app, so you can control aperture and all different kinds of frame rates to really create cinematic looking video just from your iPhone. And it's just absolutely beautiful.
So I might describe it as kind of like a little square-ish looking, maybe the size of a bottle cap. And that this thing has lenses goes over the lens of your smartphone.
Yeah. So it looks looks sort of like the size of a matchbox, maybe a little bit thicker. And the Moment case is just like a regular phone case that you snap on, and it works for Apple and Google phones. And the lens, which is unusual because it's square, sort of twists onto the case, and it's very fast and easy to use. And yeah, so it has like a nice big solid heavy piece of glass on it.
So you need to have the case.
Yes.
There's probably a phone specific case, and then the lens. And is there more than one lens that attaches to this case? Like, do you have a choice
yes.
of them? Okay.
Yeah. So they have a series of lenses. They have telephoto, macro, all like any kind of lens that you might want. I was recently in Egypt for about a month, and I, you know, would keep four or five lenses in my pockets, and just I could swap between lenses in about 10 seconds.
And so you began by saying that this was an anamorphic lens. What is an anamorphic lens?
So an anamorphic lens is it's a very high quality type of lens that, you know, it's whenever you see a film and you see these beautiful incredibly in-depth sort of rich looking video, and you might see these horizontal lens flares, it's basic in like this widescreen letterbox look, that's indicative of being an anamorphic lens. And when you shoot just with like regular app for your iPhone, it'll basically look squeezed, and you have to unsqueeze it in order to create that. So like widescreen is the default for this lens. So it is it's a special type of lens that I think most filmmakers strive to get. And it was sort of designed for shooting on film. So, but yeah, it creates these really rich images.
So you occasionally hear about people, you know, filming a commercial or maybe even a short film using a phone. This would be how they might do it, is they might get the phone and then mm-hmm. kind of apply these sort of Hollywood-like lenses to the phone.
Absolutely, yeah. So, you know, like this lens is basically shooting as a native aspect ratio in widescreen. So it actually is sort of designed for these types of, you know, like the long horizontal iPhone. So it actually makes the things that you're shooting look even better, you know, and you can see on the Moment page, they'll show you what kind of video these lenses can shoot natively on different phones. So you can get this idea of why it does look so amazing.
And it's only $150. That's,
yeah.
It seems so, like not a lot of money for something so cool.
Exactly. So like, you know, and also like when you're shooting with a, like a regular lens, you get those lens flares that are kind of round and spotty. And because this is a flat square lens, you don't get that. So the light actually bends very differently within the anamorphic lens when compared to other types of these like round lenses.
So if a very eager young person wanted to make a film, mm-hmm. you could get a set of these lenses, you could get your phone, maybe some kind of a mount to make a tripod, and then you could actually film your great American film using these kind of lenses in a smartphone.
Absolutely. I get filmmaking interns where I actually give them a grant to make their own films. And, you know, these type of things are amazing because one, they fit in your pocket. They use the, you know, the camera that you already have with you and know how to use. And these are just incredibly high quality, you know, filmmaking tools that are fairly cheap. Like when I was in Egypt, you know, I actually had a couple of doubles of these thinking, well, if I lost one, it's, you know, $50-$75. It won't be the end of the world if I lose it. I didn't, but, you know, it's, you know, it isn't like these other lenses. Like if you rent anamorphic lenses for a red camera or other things, I mean, these can be thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
So the stakes are low.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yeah. It looks like the homepage, the website for the lens does show you how to make a film, how to mount them on tripods and lenses and stuff. So it's the lowest end of making a film that I've seen. It's actually
pretty
cool.
Amazing.
Yeah. My first documentary I actually shot with not these lenses, but something similar. 'Cause it's like 10 years ago, but I shot it on an iPhone and, you know, I premiered it at an Academy qualifying film festival, the St. Louis Film Festival, and that was all just shot on my iPhone.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. Great. Do you have, is that up on YouTube or Vimeo so people can take a look at it?
Yeah. So on my website, cameowood.com, the film is called Duka in Summer, and I shot it in Northern Mongolia. I chose iPhones just because I only had 50 pounds that had to last me for 4 weeks through the outback of Mongolia, and it needed to be waterproof. So this seemed like the easiest way to do it.
That's cool. What did you do for sound?
So for sound, what I actually had numerous iPhones and like iPods. So I would put one near my subject and then have the other one with me and then sync them later.
Cool.
Wow.
Okay, that I've got to check that out.
Yeah.
Super cool. Okay, so next up is a camera strap. Tell us why you like this one and what's special about it.
Yeah. So this is the Peak Design Slide Camera Strap. I really like Peak Design's other products, like their backpacks and bags, which are very popular here in the Bay Area. But I found this thing called the Slide. So it looks like a regular camera strap. And where you would connect the strap to the camera, instead of having something that is, you know, permanently attached, it just has these clips. So the clips are basically strings of incredibly strong material. It is just incredibly strong that would attach to your camera and leave these like little circular dongles hanging off your camera. And so that you can take the camera, clip it into your camera strap and go. And when I was recently in Egypt, I was bringing my iPhone and a mirrorless camera and a DSLR. So rather than just having numerous camera straps, which I've done in the past, and I've had all these heavy cameras, I decided instead to just have one strap, and all of my cameras have these little dongle clips attached to them, so that I could just pull the camera out of my bag, snap it into my strap, and go. And again, it only takes, 10 seconds or so to just clip them in. And I found the entire system incredibly easy to use. I never had any problems with being able to get the clips on or off, and I never had any failures where the clip failed. So I found this incredibly useful.
It's also useful if you're using the same camera to carry around, then to put it onto a tripod where you sometimes don't want the strap because it's getting in the way.
Absolutely. That's a good point. I don't use too many tripods, but that is absolutely, that would be a great use for that as well. Because, you always have these like straps hanging off. So this way, yeah. I mean, the only annoying thing is just having the little dongles when you're using your phone. But in the big scheme of things, it, it's not as much of a problem as, I was like doing ballooning and doing video. And I'd much rather have, the strap holding my phone with these expensive, like these huge, anamorphic lenses on there than not. So this was very helpful.
So you also have these on your phone since you're using your phone as a camera.
Right. So the Moment case actually has like a little thing where you can put a strap on there. So I put these on the Moment case and had it, sitting around, my neck with the thing. And then this strap is, big enough that I actually had it sort of crossbody. So I had my phone sort of on my hip, not just, on my stomach, which I liked a lot.
Right. That's another advantage, is that you could have more than one kind of strap. You could have a wrist strap. You could have a shoulder strap. You could have this sort of hip strap. And you could just swap between those pretty fast too.
Absolutely. And they have different widths of these as well. Like you mentioned, they have this system works for a clutch, which goes on your wrist. They have, like a really thick strap, like for heavier DSLR cameras, or a thinner strap for iPhone or mirrorless cameras.
It's a system.
It's a whole system. And you can also, if you have their bags, you can also like attach it to the bag itself. I wasn't sure if it was going to work, but I found it to be absolutely invaluable while I was in Egypt, and just, swapping between cameras and lenses, and it helped make everything much faster.
That's really great. Okay, so the Peak straps, slide straps. So tell us about your third tool.
Yeah, so, I understand that like everyone has their favorite charger. I just happened to randomly get this charger while I was in an airport, and I had forgotten whichever one I usually had at that time. And now I have two or three of these. So this particular charger is by, I think it's actually called a company called MyCharge. The reason why I like it is that, it looks sort of like a small silver brick that we sort of become familiar with. It's silver. It sort of has the shape of a book. And it's about, 6 or 7 inches. Oh, here it is. So it is 4.6 inches by 2.8 inches by around 1 inch. And it weighs about 1 pound. So I love this thing because, one, I don't need to find a plug. It doesn't have anything extra. It just has a little like flip down wall plug. So I just plug it into any wall. It has two cables built into it. So it has an iPhone cable, which I use an iPhone, and also has a micro USB so I can charge other people's stuff. And in the bottom of it, it has just a regular USB plug. So I can plug any kind of USB device into it. It is huge. So it's 10,500 milliamp hours. So it can charge my iPhone, my iPad fully multiple times. I've been in film festivals where I've been like waiting for the next film and everyone's phone is dying. And so I've been able to charge like 3 phones at a time on this while we're all waiting in line. And so I find them, especially like on things like, international flights where sometimes, the in-seat charging isn't working. I'm able to, watch movies and do all kinds of work just using, one or two of these. So I find them just massively useful, especially when I'm traveling in the outback.
Speaking of traveling, is there any issue of them being too big for an airplane?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I've you know, I've used it going to China, I've used it going to Mongolia, a few other places, and nope, I've never had a problem.
I love the fact that the battery is completely self-contained. Like you said, you just can plug it right into an AC outlet and it has the cables. That's like a huge improvement over the kind of existing power bricks that are out there.
Yeah. I mean, so right now I do have to carry an extra cable for my iPad because it needs the USB-C. Mm-hmm. But you know, in general, you know, with this, I never have to worry about having an extra cable. I just pop them out, plug it into whatever device it is, and go. So it makes everything much simpler.
And it looks like it's about $90 on Amazon. Mm-hmm. And so like 1,000, or is that 10,000 milliamps?
Yeah, it's 10,000.
10,000, yeah. Oh my gosh.
It's insane.
Huh. So that lasts, I mean, I guess if you're just charging a phone, that'd be days, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've actually used, so the reason why I have two is that sometimes I'm, you know, going somewhere where I don't have access to charge my phone for a few days, and I can charge all my devices for days with this.
That makes sense. Like Mongolia, right?
Exactly. Well, so like with Mongolia, I had a solar charger. So what I would do is I would have one charging with solar and the other one was out with me. And then I'd switch it every couple of days once I got enough sun to charge it.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Cool. Okay. Yeah. My charge. So tell us about then your fourth
so,
selection here.
Yeah. So I've been using these folding heavy duty bags for about 3 years now. And these are super low tech, but they are amazing. So these are square bags that are about maybe a foot and a half square. They're sort of almost cubes. They fold incredibly small. They have a solid piece of plastic built into the bottom that kind of folds down so that it has a solid bottom. But I use these. They can carry up to about 45, 50 pounds in each. So I can use these for carrying like heavy liquids around. I use them at home because if you, they're just rectangular enough that you can sort of stack them. So I can use them for, you know, whenever I have donations, I can load those in, fill them with cans. I can use them for absolutely anything. You know, every time I go to the grocery store, all the packers are like, these are amazing. These are the best bags I've ever seen. Which is more ironic when you go to Whole Foods and you say, I got it at Amazon, the company that owns you.
So these bags, they're sort of unlike, say, a regular canvas bag. They seem to hold their shape. They're square. And is the idea that they will stand up by themselves?
Oh, yeah.
That's what makes them easier to, I guess, fill up or load.
Yes.
That they retain that shape. How do they retain shape? Is it, is there metal inside of the cloth?
No. So there's three sides that are solid. I believe that the rigid structure is probably some kind of recycled plastic bottle, plastic sheet that's a little bit thicker than you would expect. So the two sides that have the handles are the rigid plastic sheet. And then the bottom has that fold down rigid plastic sheet. And then the other two sides are like a thinner material that's a little bit more flexible. Mm. And they, you know, they fold up completely flat. I can fit about 25 folded bags inside of one bag.
Wow.
And as you know, and just like it looks in the picture, they actually stand up rigid. So I can, you know, set the foldable bottom in. And, you know, in all the bags as I'm ready to load, and they all just sit ready and open and ready to go.
Yeah, it's almost like a cardboard box in the usability of it.
Absolutely. And when I first got them, I was like, oh, I hope they don't fall apart. And then I'm, you know, creating more trash. But I have about 40 of these, and I use them everywhere all the time. It is insane how often I use these bags.
They look great. They come in a lot of different colors. What colors do you have?
I have black and gray. I'm super boring. But yes, they have like blue and they have all kinds of colors. They have some that zip on the top. So they have all different types. But yeah, the ones that I linked are the ones that I've been using now for about 6 or 7 years.
Wow. So they hold up.
Yeah, I've never had one die. It's crazy. Like, they've lasted just an obscenely long time.
And are they all the same size? Mm-hmm. It looks like they're different sizes, but maybe they're not.
No, no, that's just a strange photo. No, they're all uniform size. And if they fold mm-hmm. up, you could, like I said, you can fit them all into one of these. So about 25 mm-hmm. folded bags will fit perfectly into mm-hmm. one.
Yeah, we use our Trader Joe recycle bags, but these would be so much easier to to load and move around.
And then when you put them in your trunk, they all stay perfectly, you know.
Yeah, right. They're not going to tip over.
Exactly. So if you need to, like, you know, like chips or fragile fruits or whatever, like, they will protect them.
Cool.
Yeah. They're amazing. I was just, like, thinking about, like, what I was going to do for this. And I'm like, you know what? This is something I use all the time that has really made a major difference to my life. So I'm going to recommend this.
That's really good.
That's great. Yeah.
So, Cameo, before we talk about your film, I just wanted to go back to the Turing's original imitation game. I think most people think that the Turing test was between trying to tell if the entity you were talking to behind a closed door was a computer or a human, but that's not the case, is it?
No. So the original imitation game that that Turing wrote about in his paper was a depiction of a party game that was popular at the time, where during a party, you would have two closed rooms, one with a woman and one with a man, and both of them would have typewriters. And the party would not know who was in which room. And they would slip questions under the doors and get typewritten answers back, typewritten so that they were more anonymous in case people couldn't mask their handwriting. And they would try to figure out who was the woman and who was the man. And Turing's original paper proposed, what if half the time we replace the lying man? Because both of them would try to present themselves as women. So the man was always lying. The woman was always presenting herself as her correct gender. What if we replaced the man half the time with an AI and did not disclose to the party who they were talking to? And so that sort of changes. So, like, growing up, you know, I always thought that the Turing test was exactly as you said. It was about a person being presented with an AI and trying to, or even a human or an AI, but really trying to get into what does it mean to be human. But that wasn't it at all. It was a much more casual conversation of, like, what gender are you? So it really changed my perception of it. And then I realized that no one had actually done the test as he had written it, which was shocking to me.
Wow. Did you learn anything interesting from doing the test?
So I did. I mean, you know, part of the funny thing was that, so I did the test as a gender guessing game. That's how I presented it. So I had, like, a whole website of a gender guessing game, and people at the time would use AOL Instant Messenger, and they would, you know, text us, and we would randomly give them a woman, a man pretending to be a woman, or an AI pretending to be a woman. And, you know, we had, I think, one person guess that an AI was involved, but we had 2,500 people or so, and not one person, other than that one guy, you know, guessed that they were talking to an AI, and they would have a 5-minute chat with each.
Wow.
When was that? How long ago was that?
So this was in, I think, 2007.
So that's at least 12 years ago.
Oh, yeah.
So you can imagine doing it now.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the results would be very similar, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's 2005. So yeah, I think that it would be even more unlikely at this point that anyone would guess. And part of it too, I mean, I think it'd be harder today because at this point we have so many discussions about gender and it's harder to have this, like, is this a woman or a man sort of conversation. It'd be a little bit stranger, I think, than it was just 10 years ago. So, it was very interesting that, you know, people thought I was just doing just a gender binary discussion as opposed to, you know, something a little bit more computer oriented.
And how well could people discern the gender? What was that like, that since that was the initial intent of it, between the man pretending to be a woman and the woman, was there much difference?
Well, people would ask questions in order to figure out who they were talking to. And so, women would sometimes ask questions that usually women might know more than men, for example, like mm-hmm. what size pantyhose do you wear? Most men don't know what the sizing is. It's unusual. And then other people will just try to get like, you know, trickier questions or, what bands do you like? And, you know, like maybe a man might say, oh, I love Britney Spears. And it's like, oh my gosh, you don't like, you're obviously a dude. Like, okay, fine. So, cause these are like college age people, you know, a little bit cynical, are probably not going to say that their favorite person was Britney Spears in 2005. So, yeah.
So what was this? What was the rate that was, was it very high for people being able to discern the genders?
Yeah. So I would say that it was around 70% of people correctly identified the woman, but the rate between identifying the man versus the AI as a woman was around the same.
Okay.
So at this point, like the lying capability of the AI versus the man was equal.
Or men were only as able to lie as well as an AI.
Exactly. Yeah. Uh-huh. And we used an AI called Alice, which was designed by Richard Wallace. And it was specifically designed for this test. Oh. But the funny thing is, like, no one really wanted to do this test. So, until we came around. So he was pretty thrilled.
Uh-huh. Well, he had a great success.
Yes.
Did you make a film about that?
No, I didn't make a film. Okay. I at this point, I think I didn't really know I wanted to be a filmmaker yet. That's so, it. Yeah.
That would be a great, funny film to do.
Yeah, it would be.
Yeah, I'll have to think about how to frame it.
Framed right. I mean, there's lots you could play with in terms mm-hmm. of, you could really have people typing behind a curtain somewhere. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But anyway, so tell us about your latest film.
Yeah. So I made a film about 2 years ago now called Real Artists. Real Artists is a film about a young woman who is interviewing at her dream job at an animation studio and finds that films are no longer made entirely by people and touches on artificial intelligence and memory erasing drugs. And, you know, the film, it's funny. So many people think it's a type of dystopia, but it wasn't really intended to be that way. I think that, you know, Kevin, one of the things that I think that your book and your, you know, historically what you've talked about is that, you know, people have so much anxiety and fear about AIs. And so one of the things that the movie touches upon is this idea of an AI generating stories and ideas, animating it, and only using human interaction as a taste tool, like having people watch the film, read their biofeedback and how they are enjoying it, and then make adjustments. And that these are like, you know, Pixar level beloved films. And so some people are like, this is horrible. You're taking away artistic integrity. And other people were thinking, this is great because this means we get awesome films and no one has to necessarily make them other than just watching them and giving their biological feedback. So it's sort of funny how many people think it's like a Black Mirror dystopia. Whereas I think it's like, well, it's already happening. I don't know why we're so upset about it.
Is this a short film or is it a feature length film?
Yeah. So it's a short film. It's okay. 12 minutes.
And is it available for people to see right now, or how do
Absolutely.
They see it?
Yeah. So if you go to the website realartists.film, it's available on iTunes and Amazon Prime, and it's all over the place. It's also on TV. It's on PBS. It's on the Aspire channel. So, and it's also currently playing right now at the Wing Luke Museum in Seattle as part of a Asian Pacific science fiction exhibit.
Wow. And you filmed this with did you use your phone to film this?
No. So, my first film I did with a phone. And then for this film, I decided to shoot it on 35 millimeter film.
Wow. Oh my gosh. That's old school.
It's super old school. Yeah. So it was pretty amazing. We shot it at the Chabot Space and Science Museum, which is in Oakland. So we got the whole place to ourselves. And yeah, so we shot it over the course of 3 days. But if, you know, when you see it, there's like a lot of special effects, and those took about 6 to 7 months to build. Although hilariously, we'd never done special effects before, so most of it was done in Keynote.
Keynote.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's and it's funny because, yeah, well, you know, part of it is that the person who was helping me design all this, he did some of it in Illustrator, but a lot of it we, you know, primarily worked in Keynote. And
wait, my mind's still boggled here. Keynote, which is, you're talking about like the PowerPoint.
Yeah.
How is that even possible?
Well, you can actually create pretty complex animations in Keynote and then export them as QuickTime files. So that's what we did. And so we would like give these Keynote files to our to the people who were doing like editing and some of the renderings, and they would say, this isn't really how you do VFX.
Wow. And
yeah, but you know, I think that the best tool to use is the one that you have.
Yeah.
So we didn't really know what to do, but the reality is that, you know, Real Artists has probably gotten like 20, you know, Academy qualifying awards just for our VFX and computer graphics.
Wow.
Which is so hilarious.
Wow.
So yeah, I mean, you know, it's, I think it's, you know, I'm really good at Keynote. so you know, it's just kind of how that works. And even now, like I just had this film festival, Coven Film Festival this year, and we were trying to do some animation for that, and I had these two interns, and they were like, oh gosh, we don't know how to use these VFX programs that everyone's recommending online. I'm like, just use Keynote. And they're like, wait, what?
You should do a tutorial on how to do effects with Keynote or movies.
Yeah, that's like how to do special effects with popsicle sticks. It's like, what?
Yeah, so when you see Real Artists, you're kind of going to freak out about how crazy Keynote is.
Wow, okay. That's a cool tool. There you go. So where's the best place for people to find you online, social media or whatever? What do you have, some websites, handle?
Yeah, my website is cameowood.com. My Twitter is just Cameo. My Instagram is cameowood. And I'm also on IMDb. You can see all the other films that I've made and I've produced. And my Vimeo is Charming Stranger.
Are you on to something now? Are you doing something new?
Yeah.
Now that you've established this other film?
Yeah.
What are you working on?
So first of all, it's so funny, like Real Artists is just never ending. Like I mentioned, we have this museum thing and we just got nominated for an Emmy this past week, which is just crazy.
Congratulations.
Yeah. So that's just,
yeah, congrats.
Yeah, it's just great. Super crazy and awesome. So now the last 6 months or so, I've been involved with Sundance and I've done these labs in screenwriting for features and pilots. I did a directing lab recently. So I've been doing all that kind of work and I've been shooting other kinds of things. Like I just shot a film that had a lot of sequences in infrared, which was pretty fun. So I've been experimenting that way. And right now I'm working on a screenplay. I've been writing these screenplays and trying to find something that's really worth doing. So the thing that I'm doing right now, it's a screenplay, has a lot of artificial intelligence and augmented reality in it. We'll be starting production on that at the end of the year. I also did a narrative podcast recently and sold that. And I have a pilot that I've just recently completed. And I've also been selling that. So I've been doing a lot of writing and we'll be in like little short films and scenes like for Sundance. And now I'm going to be doing my next feature and it'll probably take a couple of years to make.
What is your podcast called?
Oh, so the podcast narrative is right now it's called Down the Wormhole, and it was based on a contest for the Sci-Fi Channel, and the prompt was Alice in Wonderland as a thriller set in space.
Cool.
So, yeah.
Down the wormhole. Yes, that makes perfect sense now. I'm late.
That line is actually in the podcast.
I'm sure. Well, this is wonderful. It's been such a pleasure to have you and those great tool picks for, particularly for those who want to follow in your footsteps and make their own films. You can do it these days. You don't need a lot of expensive equipment. You can use Keynote for all your special effects.
It's true.
Yep, Keynote and $149 anamorphic lens.
Right, exactly. Here you go. You're a set.
It's true.
You can become the next Cameo.
Yeah.
Well, cool, Cameo. Thank you so much. This is great.
Thank you so much. I had a great time talking with the two of you, and I had such a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.